from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll find out about the new book from the Indiana Historical Society, Mapping Indiana.
Cool. I'll talk with Kurt Meyer about his new novel, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
After more than a decade in the making, the Indiana Historical Society Press has released the book Mapping Indiana, Five Centuries of Treasures from the Indiana Historical Society. This beautiful coffee table book features 107 of the most dynamic and treasured maps from the Indiana Historical Society collection, just in time for the state's bicentennial celebration. Travis DiNicola spoke with Amy Vedra, Director of Reference Services, and Eric Mundell, Director of Collections Management, about the book.
Amy, Eric, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. We're really delighted to be here.
You are very welcome. This is such a beautiful book. Congratulations. You must be extremely proud.
Yeah, very.
You know, I just have to say, I mean, for the past week, I have a copy of it, and it's been sitting on my desk. Every time someone walks into my office, they stop talking, go right to the book, and start leafing through it and looking at it and just go, this is so cool. It's so beautiful. I mean, it really is just a stunning piece.
It's amazing. Thanks. We've been getting some compliments ourselves that way, and we're just thrilled to death.
Yeah. Well, it just everything about it. And we'll talk about the book in detail. But again, congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with how did this come to be? The thing that I found most curious about the subtitle of the book is Five Centuries of Treasures from the Indiana Historical Society. And I'm thinking, well, Indiana's only been around for 200 years, right? So there's a lot of other maps in here. But how did this all come to be, this book?
We have been thinking about this for quite some time. And getting back to the five centuries, Indiana's only been around for, not quite that long. But we do have representation from five different centuries in the collection. And because we did have that richness there, there's been thoughts about doing something of this nature as early as the 1990s, when former staff had kind of planted the seed for this.
There was an intern involved, right? I believe I had read.
Yeah.
There have been lots of different people involved with this book. So many people have helped with various aspects, from students that have helped as interns and done work helping to pull the maps and put the maps back. I mean, when you're talking over 100 maps, these are not small items. And so there's a lot of work that goes into just pulling them to decide which maps are going to be used. So there are interns, there are staff members, there are former staff members. So many people were involved in making this book and making it the success that it is today.
How many maps are in the total collection that you have?
We've estimated, and that's mostly due to Amy's work in cataloging the maps, somewhere around 1,700 or maybe a little more.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty strong number. And that doesn't really necessarily count the ones that are in atlas form or any other form. That's kind of...
And it sounds like the Historical Society has been collecting maps from pretty much its very beginnings.
As far as we know. We think that possibly as early as 1830 we were collecting maps, but they've been coming in piecemeal throughout that time.
So 1,700 plus, and trying to narrow that down to the 100 some that are in this book, I know there was a lot of committees and criteria, but that had to be daunting.
It really was. I came in a little bit later in the game than Eric did as far as this project is concerned. But really, when it comes down to such a rich collection, it's really difficult to decide which maps are going to make that cut. Mm-hmm. We used only about 107 maps in the book, and so that's less than 10% of the collection.
Wow.
And so we really wanted to get a good representation of different parts of the state, of different types of maps, of different time periods, of different cartographers that are highlighted throughout the book. So it really is just a very rich grouping of the types of maps and the people that were involved in map making in Indiana history.
And I would have to say that we really agonized over the ones that weren't chosen. It was it was kind of gripping at the heart when we realized there was something that we couldn't use. It's like, oh, can't we find a way to use this? But we really had to stick to our guns and focus on what was the most important, and that there was wide representation of all kinds of subjects.
So going back to the 500 year, obviously there's some maps in there, again, before Indiana was founded, that some really just gorgeous older maps of the New World, of the colonies.
Most definitely.
I mean, those were some really interesting ones to include, I thought.
For sure. And I think I'll let Amy talk about our oldest one because it's her favorite.
Yeah,
please,
it
Amy.
It definitely is. The Münster map, as we call it. I'm not going to butcher the actual name of the map. It's in German. I don't speak German. I don't deign to even know how to speak the name of this map. But we call it colloquially at the Historical Society the Münster map. And we date it from 1540. It could be as late as 1578, and that would be because there are multiple printings of this map that exist.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is an original from the 1500s, and so the paper that it's on is 1500 paper, 16th century paper.
Wow.
And so it's just a wonderful piece. And one thing that I really love about that particular map is that it's the earliest known map that contains the North and South American continents connected by a land bridge. And the interesting thing is, unfortunately, the North American continent is not very recognizable on this map. And so South America has a lot more detail that's recognizable. But North America is just one of those kind of blobs that exists. And when I use that map in show and tells and different programming that I do at the Historical Society, I do like to highlight, you know, people say, well, why do you have that map? What is important? Why is that important to Indiana history? And I say, you know, even though they couldn't tell what North America looked like at that time, Indiana's there somewhere.
In right. that blob is kind of the first image of Indiana anywhere.
We have so many early maps like that, and you know that you might think the same thing. Why do you have this? Why is this important to Indiana history? But somewhere on that North American continent, you will see where Indiana became, and so that is part of the reason why we have them. It's part
That
whole genesis, and to the point you actually have the state of Indiana formed.
How did the society acquire that map? Do you know? The history of that at all?
Recall that was a purchase, and I think that we acquired that around, I want to say, either in the late 1980s or early 1990s. Okay. I would have to double-check that.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, we did have a small budget for some acquisitions like that, and it wasn't, you know, terribly expensive, as I recall. But it became available, and we were able to get it.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. And now we're back to Travis DiNicola's interview with Amy Vedra and Eric Bundle about the Indiana Historical Society's book, Mapping Indiana.
Now, with maps that old, or even more newer maps, I mean, maps are used. They're not just, you know, usually hung up on the wall or put in some case. I mean, they're folded, they're rolled, what have you. So that's certainly something you have to deal with, the conservation of these maps. How do you store them? And then also, how do they get photographed to be put in a book like this?
Well, that's quite a process. Speaking to the conservation, that's something we always have to keep an eye on, the maps that we've had, as we went back through the collection and cataloged them. Up until really the 21st century, we didn't have much of a cataloging record for these. And so we began that project, particularly with an intern who had map cataloging experience and did that work for us. And once we were beginning to go through the process of making these publicly accessible, which they'd kind of been tucked in drawers before, once we had that cataloging done and we were in the process of doing it, we saw that there were needs and that these things had to be treated. And so we would have very specific requests written up to conserve maps properly. There are still a great many of them that haven't had attention and are maybe in a rolled format, or they're too large to put in file drawers. But we do put them in acid-free folders. We label them, we identify them, and then we store them flat in file drawers for the most part. Anything that we've had cataloged and is pretty much accessible is done that way.
Okay. And then in terms of actually getting the images into the book?
So we have a great staff that is our preservation imaging department. And so they've been able to take items from our collection and digitize them either using scanners. We have different sizes of scanners, roll scanners. We have a great photographer on staff who, if something's too large to put through a scanner, they can use a special type of board and do a photograph of that particular item. And so that's the way that a lot of these were done for the book and were made accessible so that we could put those images into this great
The quality piece. Of the book is just exceptional. I mean, the image reproduction, the quality of the paper. I mean, for a book that's under $60, it's awesome.
And I think that represents the quality of the people who were working behind it, too. We had such a great team, and our graphic designer, Stacy Simmer, was out of this world in terms of what he was able to do and design it and get it tweaked just right. I mean, he went through painstaking work to do that, and we're just so appreciative of the arts and craftsmanship that he was able to bring forth.
Let's talk about some of your other favorite maps, because there's so many cool ones in here.
Oh, there are.
I have to say, the ones that really struck me, the section on the bird's eye view maps, whether it be, I'm trying to think of some of the different communities that are included, Madison.
Greencastle.
Greencastle. Yeah. Oh, okay. Absolutely. I mean, these beautiful paintings.
Yes. Lafayette, South Bend.
Indianapolis.
They're just gorgeous pieces.
Yeah. We're particular fans of the bird's eye. We do like them.
Tell me about some of those maps. I mean, those seem really interesting, that style of it's got sort of a three-dimensional feel to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very much a look from above. You get a lot more. It's more than just a map. You get a lot of drawing quality to those maps. And so you're looking at these streets, and you're looking as a bird would look as it flew over.
It's almost like
towns.
A 3D type of view.
It is, and you've got little houses and your churches, and you know, if there's a river that is near or goes through the town, you've got the river shown, and it's a very interesting look at what you would see if you were looking at your community from above. And these were all done in the 1850s to 1880s. And
okay, so explain that to me, because 1850s, 1880s, you're not up there with a drone or, you know, or even a hot air balloon. I mean, how were these imagined?
And I think there's a little gap in time there, too, that the earliest one we have is from Indianapolis in the 1850s. Mm-hmm. Now, it is less of a bird's eye, quotes, bird's eye view, because it's more elevated. It was seen looking downtown from about the position of where the public library is now. Mm-hmm. So someone was there looking out from the Institute for the Blind and envisioning the city of Indianapolis at that time. So it was less, up high and more elevated. But the later maps, the ones from post-Civil War, it was really more of a post-Civil War phenomenon when you got the truly elevated views, the bird's eye level views where you're looking down on those communities, and those were just really becoming very prolific in the 1870s, 80s.
I mean, the artistry, the imagination there.
I think by that time you have communities that were beginning to have more of an interest looking back at their history. You had communities that had been around maybe 50 years, maybe 75 years, and they were interested in the development of their communities and what they were by then. And so I think and there was a certain marketing that was going on with those kinds of maps, and they were nationwide. You found them in communities all across the country.
What are some other maps that stood out for each of you that you were like, wow, I'm so glad we have that in our collection, we're able to include that in the book? Amy?
I did a section in the book on county maps, and we included just three maps, and that is such a small portion of the county maps that we have. But we were able to highlight each part of the state, so a northern part of the state, the southern part of the state, and the central part of the state. And although descriptive map of unsold lands near the head of Lake Michigan, embracing parts of Porter and all of Lake County, Indiana, is near to my heart because I grew up in Lake County. Mm-hmm. Probably the most interesting map of that county map grouping is called Wayne Co., and it's a Wayne County map, but it describes the rural free delivery service in Wayne County in 1915. Hmm. And so these were the ways that the rural populations were getting their mail. And so it's so important to have a map like that that shows that maps are more than just a way to get from point A to point B. It's showing you that there are important and key facts that go into some maps for different time periods. And rural free delivery was something that was started in the late 1800s, didn't get a lot of traction, got a little bit better once McKinley came into office, and then, but wasn't terribly long-lasting. And so it's a very neat little snippet of history for a small Indiana, you know, for an Indiana county.
And there's so much history in each one of these maps, different ways of looking at the world that people were living in then and how we look at it now. Of course, you can't help but want to compare it and, you know, find where you live on the map or what have you. Eric, what's a map that also stands out for you?
I have several, but I kind of like
to say, it's like picking your favorite child, right?
I kind of like to say I'm fond of some of the Italian cartographers, and I also like the maps that kind of show you more of a story. Mm-hmm. Now, there's one particular map that the mapmaker Antonio Zatta was accused of plagiarism off of a famous Mitchell map, and the essay outlines that and kind of puts the two together so that the reader can kind of determine for themselves, well, did he actually steal this or was it borrowed? Hmm. Mapmakers borrowed a lot of ideas from each other for centuries, and that was kind of a common practice. It wasn't, you know, necessarily thought of so much as stealing another artist's work. But it's interesting to look at that story. I also like comparing the John Carey map and the Thomas Hutchins map, which is both of them are two of the earliest representations showing the name Indiana on a map. Mm-hmm. Now, that section of land that was Indiana was not anywhere close to where we are. It was in West Virginia. But that was a parcel of land that was created with the intention of a colony going there. And there were a number of people who were contributing to that project, including Benjamin Franklin. Mm-hmm. And so they had hoped to develop that. Well, this little thing called the Revolutionary War kind of got in the way, and so it kind of went by the wayside. But the name, it's interesting that, you know, you see Indiana on that map, you know, in the 1770s, and yet 30 years later, it's showing up again in the Northwest Territory and then in as a state. So I really like the idea of that concept of seeing the earliest incarnation of the name.
So in addition to the book, there's also an exhibit that's going on at the History Center. Tell me just briefly about that. Amy?
So that exhibit is highlighting just a very small selection of the maps that were used for the book. It's going to run until April 2nd. It is up and viewable now. And our exhibits department was able to take some of the most interesting and some of the most dynamic maps from the book and really put them on display. And so people can really kind of get up close and personal with those maps.
That's
of
great.
Course, they're in very specific framing and made so that it can be as a good a situation as possible for those originals to be on display.
Of course.
But those are available so that people can really see those pieces in their original size, because you're not going to necessarily get a full-size map in the book.
Yeah, I'm excited about seeing that exhibit, and in part just for that reason, to see the texture of the paper and see how big some of these maps really
exactly.
are.
I don't think you'll be disappointed. And the exhibitions team really made a nice selection representative of what they were wanting people to see and learn about the state and about the collection that we have. And they did a good job. They worked from the book, but they kind of put their own bent on that, and it really has turned out beautifully.
Well, one map that I was really pleased to see that's in there is the literary map of Indiana from the 1950s. As someone who has been involved in creating the new literary map that just came out, 200 authors for the bicentennial, to be able to look back at that old one is just awesome to see that. I had only seen some very small reproductions before, and there's a great reproduction introduction in the book, and it's just really kind of fascinating to see that as well.
Yeah.
And it's nice to include maps like that also.
Yeah, that's a great genre type. And we also have things like the Lincoln map that shows the life of Lincoln mm-hmm. extending from Kentucky to Indiana and to Illinois. So there are themed maps of that nature, and we have a section covering that. And it is a very... very nice representation. So people learn something from that. I mean, they learn who the famous literary greats were mm-hmm. of Indiana, or they learn all the places that Lincoln lived. And so they're great to have.
Yeah, and something like that literary map is such a vibrant color. It's this bright yellow with this great blue border. And, you know, it just really is distinctive in its display of this very interesting topic of Indiana, and all these authors from different parts of the state are highlighted in a picture of the author, or a picture of the book, or a picture of something relating to the author that they're talking about. I think there's maybe a drawing of the old swimming hole for Riley. Mm-hmm. And so it's really highlighting the works, not only the works themselves and the authors themselves, but these very interesting drawings that relate to those literary figures.
Well, you know, in a time when I'm sure this isn't lost on you, and you know, people are using Google Maps or you know, their GPS or what have you, it's nice to be reminded of what a beautiful and functional map can look like.
There's nothing quite like seeing the real thing.
Travis DiNicola with Amy Vedra, Director of Reference Services for the Indiana Historical Society, and Eric Mundell, Director of Collections Management for the IHS. The book, Mapping Indiana, 5 Centuries of Treasures from the Indiana Historical Society, is available for just $59.95 in the Basile History Market at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center, or you can get it online at indianahistory.org. Those who enjoy the book will also enjoy the new exhibition at the History Center. From Saturday, February 13th to Saturday, April 2nd, 30 maps from the IHS's collection will be on display in the Rosemary McKee Lanham Gallery. Get more information at indianahistory.org. Again, indianahistory.org. Travis?
Yes, Sharon.
Regardless of whether you believe Punxsutawney Phil's prognostication or
yes.
not,
there I feel are like I've been here before.
I know, right? Oh, I get it. There are still plenty of reasons to stay indoors and do lots of groovy arts things, and we'll bring you a whole bunch of them today on our mm-hmm. calendar that we call
What Do We Do? Well, you know what? I'm thinking about Valentine's Day, Sharon.
Are you?
Well, I mean, really,
Don't give anything away. I know Michelle listens.
It's only like a week and a half away.
Oh, I know.
And look, fellas and ladies too in some cases, if you haven't started planning yet, here's a couple ideas.
Okay.
So one is at Indie Fringe through the month of February up through the 20th. The play Impressionism is being presented at the Indie Fringe, and with a really great cast directed by Amy Hayes, and it's sort of an interesting kind of quirky love story set in an art gallery. And you can go see it any night you wish, but if you go on Valentine's Day, they're doing a special champagne performance for that,
nice.
Which sounds like a lovely thing to do. It's being presented by Wisdom Tooth, the Wisdom Tooth Theater, and you can get more information if you go to the Indie Fringe website to check out Impressionism and also some other great shows that Fringe is doing throughout the month, including Jason Adams, Face Your Fears, and Act of Foo Improv, and also at the end of the month, the Vagina Monologue, which could be an interesting Valentine's Day gift as well.
I'm not going to comment on that. Mm-hmm. We're just going to segue to mm-hmm. my reminder, and I just did this myself for someone who's receiving a Valentine from me, don't forget that locally made works of art, including CDs by local musicians, paintings by local painters, jewelry by local jewelers, that is a perfect idea for your Valentine.
Absolutely.
Think local. But, hey, I also learned recently, did you know that there are official anti-Valentine's colors?
No. What are they?
Thanks to Encore Vocal Arts, I know that they are green and black. And who makes this stuff up? I suspect the Hallmark card company, which is now manufacturing anti-Valentine's. Anyway, Encore Vocal Arts is doing a concert on Valentine's weekend, Saturday, February 13th, with a 5 o'clock and a 7:30 concert. It's at the Basile Opera Center at 40th and Pennsylvania Streets. And it's called He Loves Me, She Loves Me Not. And if you're in a relationship or you believe in love, you're invited to make a statement by dressing in pink and red. Or if you're like, boo, down with love, love is awful, you're invited to wear green and black.
Nice.
So I'll just leave it there. Take a date or take a friend.
Okay.
Or go stag.
Well, okay, here's another Valentine's thing. Now this is actually, it takes place after Valentine's. It's on February 21st, but it's a dinner at Mesh that's being presented by No Exit. And if you know No Exit's work, they do weird, fun, experimental theater. Anyway, so I have no idea what they're doing, but if you have the type of Valentine who would appreciate that, they probably wouldn't care that it's on February 21st and not on the 14th. So dinner, a romance in four courses, presented by No Exit at Mesh on Mass. You can get more information at No Exit's website if you search that.
Yeah, if you're Valentine, or maybe you like wine, the Courses Restaurant, which is run by students and faculty and staff of Ivy Tech Culinary Institute, I should say, they're doing wine tastings on Wednesday evenings in February. And they're $12 a person. You get to taste several wines and have some small bites. And you can find out more about that online. Just Google Winesday, W-I-N-E-S-D-A-Y, Ivy Tech. And they're also doing a special wine dinner on February 24th. So you can find out about that and maybe make a little gift certificate for your Valentine.
That sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Hey, the Midwinter Dance Festival is taking place at Butler. It's Butler Ballet's Midwinter Dance Festival. It goes from February 10th through the 14th. That would be Valentine's Day. And it's at the Trott Center for the Arts. And three world premiere pieces, including a work that guest choreographer Leslie Telford created specifically for the Butler Ballet graduating class of 2016, are going to be performed, as well as a whole bunch of other performances by students from the Dance Conservatory of Eva Jaksova in Bratislava, Slovakia is going to be there as well. And there's a whole bunch of different alternative programs, with program A and B being performed at different times on different days. And you can go to their website and figure out which one you want to go see, because there are a number of different performances. Actually, the best thing is go see both programs, A and B, and see it all at the Midwinter Dance Fest taking place at Butler as part of Butler Ballet.
Speaking of dance and dance in the neighborhood of Butler, Clues Memorial Hall is presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, which, as you know, has a spectacular reputation and long-term ensemble, multicultural dance ensemble with spectacular discipline and contemporary flair. That's coming up on Saturday, February 20th at Clues Memorial Hall at 8 o'clock, and you can learn more about that at cluesHall.org.
Very good.
Yeah.
Hey, Mardi Gras is coming up soon as well, speaking of holidays.
Yeah.
And so Actors Theater of Indiana is having their second annual Mardi Gras gala, Let's Party Again, which is going to be a hoot. That is coming up on Saturday, February 20th at the Woodland Country Club in Carmel. And Tim Brickley is going to be playing up there. It is casual attire, and they will be giving you masks and complimentary hurricanes and hors d'oeuvres, and as well as a dinner and dancing and all sorts of fun stuff for their Mardi Gras party. You can get more information if you look up Actors Theater of Indiana for their Mardi Gras party on February 20th.
I think complimentary hurricanes automatically makes it casual, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Just one of those and you're pretty casual. Hey, maybe your sweetheart likes folk music. The Underhills weaves together guitar, banjo, fiddle, mandolin, and bass. to create a new take on the old-time folk dynamic. And they are performing as part of the Indie Folk Series on February 20th. That will be a Saturday night at UUI at 615 West 43rd Street. If you want to plan ahead, you can go online to indiefolkseries.org and find out more about that, or just show up. Another casual event.
There you go. Just show up. There's a lot of visual art openings going on this weekend. If you're listening to us Thursday night, especially for Friday night, because it is First Friday, among other things, the Young Collectors Show at Gallery 924 that we were chatting about here on Art of the Matter recently. A show that's specific. It's featuring all local artists, adults, but it's specifically curated for youngsters, for kids. So all the work is hung a little bit lower, and all the subject matter is age appropriate. Great place to take your kids. Or if you want to check out something a little bit, more different than that, then there's a lot of openings going on at the Circle City Industrial Complex this weekend as well, and then also at the Stutz Building.
You can find out what makes various artists' hearts beat over at the Stutz Gallery.
Oh, well, that sounds lovely. That sounds very romantic as well. Yeah. Well, I know it. If you don't know the Circle City Industrial Complex. It's such a really cool space. It's gone under a lot of renovation just off of 10th Street and Mass Ave, and they're having a huge open house this weekend. Among other things, new work by Carmen Hurt and a whole bunch of other studios that are going to be open as well. But the Stutz show also sounds like that's going to be a lot of fun, Sharon.
I love that very much. Hey, switching gears, you probably know about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, which is a big focus in the schools, or as we prefer to call it, STEAM, which adds arts to that mix. Well, the Ronin Chamber Ensemble has a concert coming up on Monday, February 22nd, that's kind of STEM-themed. It's science, math, and music. I guess that's technically STEAM-themed, isn't it? it's going to...
It's not like steampunk, right?
No, not quite. But don't worry, there will not be a quiz at the end of the concerts on this, but there will be laws of physics and laws of math invoked as part of this concert, which features music by Bartok, Holst, Webern, and, as they say, more. So that's at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center and the Ruth Lilly Theater inside there on Monday, February 22nd at 7:30, Science, Math, and Music, Ronin Chamber Ensemble presenting.
Oh, very cool. Hey, some great things going on at Garfield Park at the conservatory down there. I love all the events that they're doing. I mean, storytelling events and hatha yoga and things like that. One of the things that they're doing, of course, for Valentine's Day, Sweets for Your Sweetie on Sunday the 14th. And they have two different sessions for this, 6:30 to 8 p.m. and another from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. So it's in the evening. You can celebrate Valentine's Day with treats from the tropics, including chocolate and coffee, all while enjoying the candlelit romantic atmosphere of the conservatory.
Wow. You've
got to get your reservation in soon. But it's very cool down there. It's a lovely place. And what a nice thing. That'd be an unusual thing to do for Valentine's
Day. I'm going there this weekend, but maybe I'll have to go back on Valentine's Day.
And
sounds
if,
great.
You know, that doesn't work, then maybe you can check out the Crunch and Munch, which is...
I can't wait.
I love this. It's on Monday, February 22nd, 10 in the morning. It's for kids, 2 to 5. Bring the little ones, and you can meet some of the conservatory's critters and learn what they like to eat. So crunch and munch.
Not Valentine's chocolates, I'm guessing.
No.
I don't think the little critters are supposed to eat those things. Music from Finland and Russia is showcased on Northern Exposure, an upcoming concert on Friday, February 26th, repeated Sunday, February 28th. Concert by the Hendrix Symphony Orchestra. This time their performances will be at the Avon Middle School North Auditorium. Pay attention, there are two Avon Middle Schools. This is Avon Middle School North in their auditorium. Sibelius Finlandia and the Sibelius Violin Concerto featuring Trisha Frazier, as well as Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. So very lively concert, again, coming up on February 26th and 28th.
Cool. Speaking of concerts, the symphony is Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra is doing a lot in February. Of course, this weekend, as part of the Lilly Classical Series, got music from 2001, A Space Odyssey, with Christoph Urbanski, who's exploring the final frontiers with his space series. And then next, then let's see, coming up on Sunday, February 7th, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony as part of the Duke Energy's 317 series. But also on the 9th, the symphony is doing their annual Celebration of Black History concert with a free performance showcasing violinist Ade Williams, the first place laureate of the annual Sphinx competition. And so that is very cool as well. There's a concert at 7:30 on Tuesday the 9th that is a free concert at Hilbert Circle Theater that you should go check out. Mr. Ade Williams is only 17 years old, and it should be great to hear play. That's a pretty cool thing to do.
Fantastic. Hey, lost love, possibly redeemed love, is the theme of David Hare's play Skylight, which is on stage at Theater on the Square through February 13th. So if you're taking your Valentine, you're going to have to go before Valentine's Day. It concerns a pair who we think probably belong together, but they broke up a long time ago, and I'm not going to tell you too much because there's some mysteries in the plot. But Skylight on stage at Theater on the Square. Learn more at tots.org.
Okay, one more theater thing I'll throw out. Mentioned Actors Theater of Indiana's Mardi Gras event, but they are actually performing Sweeney Todd, Demon Barber of Fleet Street, and they are performing that through Valentine's
Bloody
Day.
Bloody Valentine.
That's a weird one to do. Yeah, I had to get that last one in.
I love it. Well, don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And don't worry, we're not done with our Valentine's suggestions.
Oh,
we'll be back again next week with more on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
At the beginning of Noblesville author Kurt Meyer's new novel, Dan Reynolds is removing choice pieces of architectural trim from an old house, while at the same time he's trying to salvage the pieces of his life. Sharon Gamble invited Kurt to tell us about the inspiration for this new book, and Kurt began with a reading from The Salvage Man.
Well, Dan Reynolds is doing salvage work on an old house, and at this particular moment for the passage I'm going to read, Dan's on an extension ladder up in the eaves of a house that's, we would call it an I house. It's an 1850s brick farmhouse that was turned into an Italianate a few years later with decorative eave brackets, and he's up on this ladder removing the decorative eave brackets from the house. From where he worked, his body was directly in front of the second-story windows. He could look down and into the bedrooms that had faced the road since years before Abe Lincoln took office. This second bracket was held tightly in place. He'd been able to begin loosening the first one simply by wedging his pry bar into the cracks between it and the bandboard. This one needed more persuasion. Dan pulled a framing hammer from his leather tool belt and beat at the elbow of the pry bar, wedging the bracket out, opening a quarter-inch seam in the paint between it and the eaves overhead. He positioned the bar between the bracket and the bandboard and began hammering it again to wedge it free of the backside. The metallic clang rang in his ears. Suddenly, he was startled by the shout of a shrill human voice. The words were lost among the concussive clang of the hammer. He stopped and looked about the yard. No one. Then, Dan jumped and nearly lost his balance when he saw a woman standing no more than 2 feet away from him on the other side of the glass in the upstairs bedroom. There was rage in her face, and again she yelled, "What are you doing to my house?" In the few seconds he stared, shocked into her eyes, her expression evaporated. The pinched muscles of narrowed eyes and gritted teeth fell loose into embarrassment and then opened wide into shock, not at Dan, but at her own outburst. She put her hand to an open mouth and with a start stepped backwards, dissolving out of view amid the reflective glare of sunlight and clouds in the glass. Dan clung to the ladder that only now he realized was swaying beneath his feet, having been struck hard by the startled, stiffening jerk of his legs. His heart beat wildly against the metal rung. He climbed down quickly and stepped backward through the deep grass, looking up at the windows, searching for another sign of the woman. Someone living in the house? He wondered to himself. A homeless druggie squatting in this place? Dan began a search of the house, walking room to room, with his hammer drawn as a weapon, calling out hellos to the woman. "Like I said," he called out loudly, but in as friendly a voice as he could muster, "I've got no argument with you, but you can't party here." He moved into the empty room and looked about. There was nothing, just the rungs of his ladder outside the window. He went back across the hall to the other bedroom doorway. That room was empty too, but he'd only looked in the front of the house. He walked slowly towards another doorway at the back two-thirds of the upstairs and peeked into the next room. It too was empty. There was just one room left, the one with the graffiti on the wall and a mattress on the floor. He stepped in and looked around, no sign of anyone. His eyes followed the slit between the door jamb, looking for anyone hiding behind it. Nothing. Where did she go? He'd heard no movements beside his own. Then behind him at the front of the house, he heard a soft creak. Perhaps someone on the front stairs. He moved back towards the door. Just as he crossed the threshold, a voice from behind him startled him nearly out of his skin. "Why are you tearing up this house?" she asked in a soft yet insistent voice. Dan spun around. There she stood, the woman he'd seen through the window. She hadn't been there before, he felt sure of it. There was nowhere to hide, no closet or alcove, only the back stairs and the door he'd come through. He'd seen and heard nothing just a moment before, yet there she was. Then a thought. Maybe she'd been lying on the mattress. The mere thought of the bizarre circumstances made him shudder.
Wow. So, Dan, our main character here, is at a crossroads in his life, right?
Yes, he is. You know, all the things that used to define him are gone. He had been a skilled tradesman in a factory, and I took that part of his story from my own neighborhood where there had been a Firestone plant that was, the union was busted in the 90s, and then eventually Firestone moved the operations out of town entirely. So he lost that job that had defined who he was.
Mm-hmm.
He had been married, now he's divorced. He'd been a father, now his children are grown and gone. And so all of these self-defining aspects of his life are gone, and he's feeling kind of invisible. And the way he's found to survive is to salvage items, architectural items from historic homes that are about to be demolished.
Which is an interesting kind of three-dimensional metaphor for his life. Parts of his life have been pried away. There's not much left but the essence of Dan.
That's right.
Dan is a salvage man. How do you know about that business?
You know, I have restored four historic homes of my own. And at times when I was a school teacher and my ex-wife and I were living on one teacher's salary and trying to restore a house and raise three little kids, just to make ends meet and have the things I needed to finish my projects, I began dumpster diving. Mm-hmm. When I saw somebody working on an old house, I'd crawl in the dumpster and see what they threw away, and I'd bring home oak woodwork and fireplace mantles and things like that. And I eventually ended up, you know, when I saw an abandoned farmhouse that looked like it was in bad shape, I'd find the owner and find out what they planned to do with the house. And if it was going to be demolished, I would do salvage there. And things that I didn't need for myself, I either gave to neighbors or I sold to, you know, antique salvage yards here in downtown Indianapolis.
And that's salvaging is more common than we probably know.
Well, and
sadly,
it's become very competitive, and I quit doing it just because the value was starting to become recognized, and it was a lot of hard work to do.
Sure.
And you see it now in antique stores all the time.
Mm-hmm. Where did the idea for this novel come from?
Well, the house that's in the story that Dan is salvaging actually existed in my early years as a real estate agent. I sold this property. It was a beautiful farmstead that was begun probably in the 1850s. It had a milk house that matched the main farmhouse. It had a beautiful old barn.
What's a milk house?
Well, it's where you store the milk.
Okay.
From that you've, you know, taken from the cows. It's a, you know, a lot of stone and a lot of brick to keep the place cool.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, doing salvage in houses, you have interesting thing happen in houses. Sometimes houses make you feel very comforting and welcomed. And I've been in other houses. I'm not really a superstitious person, but houses that make you feel like they really wish you weren't there, that give you a creepy feeling. And I can remember doing salvage with a friend, and he'd been in the house first, and he refused to go back in, and he was not a foolish person.
Wow.
He simply said, "I just have a feeling that something bad happened in that house."
Hmm.
And those experiences laid the groundwork, but also living in Hamilton County, a place of such a dramatic change, and in my day job as a real estate agent, I do often encounter people who grew up in Hamilton County in the 1960s and 70s, and they had an idea what their lives would be like,
mm-hmm.
and that's all been taken away from some people by change.
Sure.
You know, we look at the growth and we think about the good things that happen, but there are losers in that change, and we often don't tell their stories. And so that's why I decided I would tell Dan's story in that way, to show how a person can get lost among all of that wealth and growth and change.
And once a single person starts feeling that change, there becomes kind of a group think about it, and people kind of tacitly don't talk about it. There's a beautiful scene late in the novel where Dan attends a high school reunion with his now ex-wife and just has a moment where he speaks the truth to all of these people.
Yeah, he's had a little bit too much to drink, and he's never been a man that was very good at expressing his emotions, and it all just comes out, and he makes a rather big comment at the end saying, "I'm invisible. It's like I don't exist at all." You know, the house where he was raised had been demolished for a parking lot. So much of the touchstones, the elementary school he went to had been demolished and a new elementary school built. So it's just all so different for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not his place at all. He feels very invisible. And the other character that he meets in the book is very much in the same situation.
Absolutely.
And together they have to find meaning and find purpose in their lives again.
They have to figure out how to reinvent themselves.
Yes, they do.
So you're not a superstitious person, but this is the second novel in a row you've been on our program talking about.
Yes.
That has a little bit of an element of, what would we call it?
It's not supernatural.
Another dimension?
And it's not magical realism, but I like...
A parallel world? A parallel dimension?
Could be. I guess there is a little bit of supernatural in this book, and mm-hmm. we'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that idea. I like the way that it can create an interesting way to discuss people's problems.
Mm-hmm.
You get to see them in a new way, rather in the rote sort of way we normally look for solutions in life.
Mm-hmm. How does being a realtor feed your life as a writer, or the other way around? I don't know which way it works.
You know, as a realtor, it's an interesting thing. I feel fortunate that I took as much psychology as I did in college. I was a school teacher before I was a realtor.
What did you teach?
Lot of graphic arts, photography, construction, manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to take a lot of educational psychology in the process of getting a teaching degree. And in real estate, I often see people at their best, brightest, most hopeful moments. You know, maybe a young couple buying their first house. They can't even believe they're old enough to buy a house. You know,
aww.
And it's so exciting to do that. And then you often see people at their most broken, after a divorce, after a job loss, and the house becomes that final reminder of who they once were. I've held hands with many divorcees at closings who, you know, the house symbolizes the end of their marriage.
Mm.
And even though maybe they've been divorced a year or two, but they're finally selling the house, and it can be a very emotional thing. But also, you'll notice in both of the books that you've interviewed me about, there's a lot of architecture and a lot of old houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I have specialized in selling old houses, and that probably makes up 50% of my business.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, you know, that 50% are all pre-World War II houses.
Why are you drawn to that era and before?
You know, I don't really know. I think, you know, the first house I restored was built in the 1890s, and I spent a good deal of time researching the people, the first family that lived in the house, and the man who had built the house.
Really? What did you learn about him?
Actually, I found a grandson. This was back in the mid to late 80s. I met a grandson, a very elderly grandson of the man who had built my house, and he was actually a tour guide at the Gamble House in Los Angeles.
In Pasadena, yeah.
Yeah, and he came through Indiana once and gave me a tour of Noblesville, telling me about what life was like growing up in Noblesville in the 1920s. But researching that family and thinking about what their lives were like, finding remnants of a summer kitchen, and you think about the fact of you were moving a stove into the house in the winter and out to a summer cooking spot in the summertime to get the heat out of the house. And that's just always fascinated me. It's something that it's a little bit like, there's a famous saying that the past is a foreign country, and it is a little bit like a foreign country. It's a place that's somewhat familiar to us, but is all gone. And I just find that very compelling that I'm living out my life in this place where so many other people, the physical rooms where so many other people lived, where people died, where babies were born, where birthdays and weddings were celebrated. There's just an endless amount of material.
Sharon Gamble with author Kurt Meyer. His newest novel, The Salvage Man, is available at his website, kurtameyer.com. That's Kurt, KURTAMEYER.com, kurtameyer.com. Or you can check it on Amazon. Again, kurtameyer.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll find out about Spotlight Theater's production of Blues for an Alabama Sky at Theater at the Fort in Lawrence.
I'll talk with Ellen Rosenthal about her time at Conner Prairie and learn about a new book that she's written about Conner Prairie.
And I'll get a preview of the Indiana Art Fair at the State Museum. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.